Mason Brownlow, welcome to the show. Thanks, really mate. Appreciate you coming on. Thanks, buddy.
Thanks for having me.
We're friends in Algarve, part of this whole refugee group, but it's great to meet so many cool people. So I thought it'd be great for us to chat about your background in design and print and your time at the FA. But also, we've got a connection with, you know, the protests during COVID. Why we're in Algarve? So tell us a little bit about how you've ended up here in Algarve with me and all of the others in our little crazy gang.
Well, it was largely COVID, all that whole nonsense that happened. We were stuck in England. Before, let's go back. We were travelling around. We had two kids at the time and we were travelling around. My wife was ill. She came out of her illness and I had a property that I'd managed to get in some kind of business deal with my company I used to work for. I ended up with this property. I forgot that I had it, basically. Sold it, made a little bit of money, and we went on the world tour. So we went travelling around the world and we went literally all over the place, you know, Dubai, Australia, Bali, Korea, Japan, Australia, everywhere. We just went, carried on moving. We were in the US at some point. We'd ended up in LA. I was doing a little bit of work there. And Sarah got pregnant. I suppose I say she got pregnant. We became pregnant.
We had a little bit pregnant.
Yeah, a little bit, yeah. And at the time it was this whole Zika virus thing was going around. Remember this thing?
Is that pre-COVID?
Pre-COVID.
Yeah, that was the first one they trialed.
Well, this was the trial, but at the time it was like, we didn't know any better. And we're thinking, we were on our way to South America and the plan was to go to Mexico, carry on traveling, carry on moving. But this whole Zika virus thing was coming in and it was, if you haven't got this jab, you haven't got that jab, you get bitten by a mosquito, this is going to happen, your kid's going to have a big head. We were like, do you know what? Our kids have got big enough heads as it is. Like, we don't have enough of them. So we thought, right, let's go back to England. Went back to England, had the baby. And then within 6 months, it was COVID, pandemics, lockdowns, blah, blah, blah. And we were then stuck in a house with three kids, nowhere to go, nothing to do.
In London was this?
Outside London, Essex, on the Essex coast. Yeah. A place called Leigh-on Sea, which got voted the happiest place in the UK to live, which is interesting because there was loads of miserable people about, especially at that time. So we were there, we were stuck. There was a little window. We'd had a few people had started to leave. We'd known a couple of people that were here already. Another one of our friends had jumped in a van and just drove off that summer, got out of here. There was a small window when we went on holiday in like the October, I think, no, maybe the end of August, September. They opened up a little window at some point. And we went on holiday, went to Greece for a week or something like that. And then we come back and we're like, right, next time, because the window shut again, they just like, they let you out for a week. And then when the window opened back up again, we were like, right, pack the stuff up, let's get out of here. And we literally packed the car up and drove to Portugal that weekend in like an October 20.
What was that, the first lockdown, second lockdown? Because the first one, they didn't really, they only paid like lip service to it here.
Yeah, it was the second one. It was coming off the very end of it. It was because when we got here, there were still people here with masks on and you had to show IDs to go into places and stuff like that when we first got here.
Yeah.
And we were just living up in a mountain away from everybody and away from people. The only time we needed to go in here was into a... Mm. And we didn't really know. We weren't down this end. We were right up the other end. We were at the top of a mountain.
What, by Sagres?
Yeah, we were in Sabrash.
Okay.
Which is closer to Faro, closer to the airport, but we were right up the hill in a nice house, but like isolated from everything. And then we were like, hey, this is nice, but we've got no one around us, there's nothing going on. And we were like other people, when you hear about English people, Portugal, where'd you go? And you know about Albufeira and Vila Moura, that's what you know, right?
Yeah.
And Val de Lobo, you go, oh, that's a bit nicer, that is. So we found this place and it was in Val de Lobo, like Golfville, you know?
Nice. It's a golden triangle, is that a
golden triangle? It's where all the boomers go and all the golfers go, you know what I mean?
Yeah.
So we moved there, but then you're there and you've got a three month window of there being people around and their stuff around. The rest of it is just completely dead because people have got these big, beautiful houses that they go to for three months of the year or 2 months of the year. And then we'd started to meet a few more people down this way, realised there's actually a little bit more of a vibe and a community down this way, which is really what like Sarah missed. Like I'll lock myself in a room and work basically, so I don't need to be out, but Sarah missed having people around her. And then when we come down here, we know people here. it was a perfect fit, really. Like you say, like it's a load of like it's like a nice refugee camp.
It is. And you've got to make a bit of an effort to get here. So in a way, it kind of acts as a filter too.
Yeah.
You know, because most Brits who come to Algarve, they go direct to Albufeira, and that's not a place that you really want to go. It's a bit like Blackpool, isn't it?
Exactly,
I guess.
Yeah.
So if that was your only experience of Algarve, you probably wouldn't want to come back. No. But you can go in either direction, and it gets all different. You know, you need to go to the east towards Tavira, and then on to Seville. But that's a bit older. But if you go west, like here, then it gets really interesting. It's a real mix of people.
It's a pass through town, isn't it? Like, it's because you have to go all the way to, we're on the very bottom southwest tip, right?
Yeah.
So if you get to that southwest tip at Sagres, and you go straight, if you was to jump in a boat and go straight, you'd end up in New York, I think it is.
That's right.
In a dead straight line. But what a lot of people do is there's all this like, there's a load of surfers, there's a load of hippies, there's a load of van life people.
Digital nomads, sailors,
and they're all passing
golfers,
through. So it's not really a place where people, this isn't really a place where people settle, really. Like there's a lot of passing through a movement, and if you go 2 hours that way, you're in Seville. You go 2 hours that way, you're in Lisbon. So it's like a nice bit, like you say, you have to really make an effort to get here, and then to be here and stay here, I guess, as well.
Yeah, it's cool. I really, really enjoy it here. I mean, it's a bit quiet now at the moment, isn't it? We're in the...
Not compared to last year.
Really?
Well, you want to see it last year. Last year was much quieter this time of year.
Okay.
And the year before that, if you go down to the Black and White, the coffee shop, where Sarah goes every time, they shut down for the whole of January, not last year, the year before. And then
why do you think that is then? Do you think
there never used to be people here?
Do you think that's because more and more people are coming, or is that they're finally starting to get over the tragedy that was COVID for this area? Because, you know, they closed a lot of businesses down here, didn't they, during COVID? Because it relied so much upon British tourism.
Yeah.
And, you know, after the Portuguese, during the first lockdown, they like, this is okay, we'll do it. Yeah, no problem. They just gave a lip service.
Yeah.
And for the second one, the Brits went, No. Yeah. This time you're going to take it serious, because what we're going to do is put you on the red list.
Yeah.
And they put them on the red list, and that meant that no tourists, because remember they were saying back at home, if you travel to a country that's on the red list, you're going to jail for 10 years.
Yeah.
Matt Hancock was saying he was going to bang us up for 10 years for visiting Portugal. But what happened is that all tourism just stopped.
Yeah.
And here in Algarve, they were struggling, really, really struggling. So the Portuguese government went, okay, we'll play along. We'll play the game. You want us to ramp it up, we'll ramp it up. And that's kind of what happened. But I think that is coming to an end now, and people are starting to return in more numbers, and it's getting livelier.
There's different people coming here now as well. Like, down here, there's not a lot of English tourists that come here, or UK tourists that really come here. So a lot of Americans, a lot of people from all across Europe, and you'll see it when you're walking around. You can hear the voices and you can see the people. And there's not as many British tourists down this end and down it, because they're just not. I know the Portuguese government opened they've got like trade deals and stuff with the US government, haven't they? So to make it easier for them to move around, and visa stuff is easier for US citizens to get here and to move around, which is interesting. I know a few people that moved up to Lisbon, and you would think, wow, like one guy one of these coaches, like a business coach, and he was living in Nashville, really successful business, and he just upped and left and came to Lisbon. It's like, wow, you've come from there to here. It's interesting. I like people that are coming here, like, you've got to want to come here. And I always say, like, people go, oh, why did you move there? And it's like, well, tell me what's good about it. And it's like the clock, you know, like it's silent, the clock's ticking. Because you can't put your finger on it.
No.
But it's convenient. Like, it's really convenient.
It's 2 hours from England, isn't it?
It's 2 hours from England. It's the weather's nice.
Yeah.
The people are, like, the Portuguese people are great. Yeah. The reason I like them is because they're like me. Like, don't bother them. Don't talk to me. We won't talk to you almost, you know? Like, that's what I think is great, because you can walk down the street and no one's going to bat an eyelid at you. But then at the same time, if you engage, they're going to engage, you know? And I quite like that. But I can never put my finger on it. It's not like, oh my God, this is paradise. And it's not paradise. It's just really cool.
It's not quite paradise, but it's pretty cool.
Yeah.
Though.
Yeah, it's really convenient. Like you say, you can travel around. You can.
Yeah.
But the other thing I always like about it is you're on a landmass, being stuck on that island and being told that I'm locked in and I can't get off because I haven't got a boat.
I know.
Petrified me a little bit, like a caged bird syndrome, isn't it? Is what they call it.
Especially with the threats that they were given, especially with the propaganda that they were pumping through the airwaves. We're like, whoa, this feels like a little bit fucking prison island, getting out of this place. You know, if that's how they're going to treat us, their own citizens, fuck you. You know.
And I know that if I'm here, if I need to, I can drive to real communism. I can drive to China. I can drive to Russia from here if I need to on one landmass. It might take me a week or two or whatever, but I can get there. There's a whole big place that I can explore and chuck the kids in and chuck the family in if I need to escape. Then I can, do you know what I mean? And like the same thing as well is if I need to go back to England for whatever reason, some work or whatever, if I need to jump on a plane to Spain's an hour away, England's hour and a half away, plus a half hour in the car, and it's really easy. Like I said to you, didn't I had a job in Liverpool last year. I was living up near Farrow Airport. If I was back in Essex, I had to be in Liverpool by 11:30 that morning. I would have had to leave probably 5-6 in the morning, drive up, get stuck in a bit of traffic, be knackered, get to Liverpool just on time. I left my house here at like 8 o'clock, breeze to the airport, straight through, jumps on the plane. I was in a Liverpool town centre by 11. It was quicker for me to get there from Portugal than it would have been from outside of London.
It's packed. The island of Great Britain is packed and the infrastructure is creaking. Yeah. It's ancient. It doesn't fucking do what it's supposed to do. You can't get anywhere on time. And when you do, it costs you a fortune. It's like, you know, just driving from A to B in England is a fucking chore. Yeah. It's a real mission. It's like, I remember when I drove here, getting from Liverpool to Portsmouth was hell. It was constant traffic everywhere.
300 quid in petrol.
As soon as I arrived in Spain and drove from Spain to Portugal, the roads were completely empty. It's a whole different experience.
And you get off
it?
That boat and they just go,
yeah, mañana.
Yeah,
all right,
babe. Well, keep going.
Yeah, no, it's good. It's good. Yeah, I really enjoy being here and meeting all these great new people, including you. But tell us about your title, Creative Director. Cool title. Everyone wants to be a creative director. You actually are one. I had a little bit similar when I was doing music videos, so I kind of know that world a little bit. But tell us about, you know, what that entails, what that means.
Giving direction on creative, whatever that may be. So like for me at the moment, it's design direction, art direction, creative direction. Someone called me a Swiss Army knife a couple of weeks ago, and I wanted to headbutt them because I thought you'd taken a piss.
All right, okay.
What does that mean? But then I realised, actually, that's probably a compliment because it means I can do a bit of everything. But I like to think that I do it all to a better quality than most other people do it.
Yeah.
Because there's like different streams to where I can branch off to. Like design direction is very different to creative direction. It's not what it works. Like if you're going to make...
Is it creative direction in the same term as in the advertising world, a creative?
It's exactly, basically, there's like a structure to it.
Yeah.
I mean, I hate it. It's titles.
It is what it is.
Say we're looking at this podcast, you go, right, I want to change the direction for this podcast.
Yeah.
You would normally have creative director comes up with a load of ideas with the creative team, comes up with a load of ideas and directions you can go off in. The creative director can normally know, has a deep understanding of the business and the goal you want to achieve to get there, and then has to work out how to do that creatively, however that may be. Film, print advertising, digital advertising, radio.
So all the different mediums that are at your disposal.
All the different mediums, yeah. And then it filters down the system. So art direction is literally the style of it. So art direction is a... Look at these posters, yeah? So a creative director will come up with the concepts. Art director will translate those concepts and how do we make that work and what do we do? What kind of camera do we use? What kind of styling do we use? What kind of things do we use? And the design director will then go and make that into a tangible design that they can roll out into a poster, a digital asset, a print asset, a this, that, and the other. So there's like a whole big system, like an agency system within it. I'm like a one-man walk-in agency because I've done it all, so I can do it all. You know what I mean? So I get hired for different people to do different things, basically.
So you've accumulated all of these like design skills, these technical skills over the years. And we were chatting about this. We were chatting about how technology is going through these numerous revolutions, and it's happening faster and faster and faster, become more and more digital. But you've been around long enough that you've seen all of the transition and revolution from the analog days in print, because you started off in print, didn't you?
Yeah, well, they used to call it as like a blanket term for like if you did anything that was back in those days, like what was it? Late 90s, so like the turn of the millennium when I started. Anything that involved a computer and a printed something at the end which was printed was you were in the print. You know, like that was just what it was called. So you could have been people would have thought I was a printer, or they didn't know what I was. I didn't really know what I was either. I was just in this office changing the bins, looking about what's going on and cleaning down the worktops before everyone got in and going to get the breakfast and paying checks in and stuff like that, you know, like a runner basically. But you started seeing what's going on and then you start absorbing it all. But those days, like So what you would do is, if you're a photographer, a fashion photographer, now you take your picture with your camera, it's plugged in, it's tethered to a computer, it comes straight up and we can retouch it while we're sitting next to you.
It wasn't like that when I first started making videos. It was, you know, you had to go through a ton of processes before you'd even got to view the material.
But in those processes, there's industry built on those processes, right? Because each thing had to be paid for. So like it used to, the cost of it used to be much bigger. Now that cost has been absorbed by the equipment. So
are the budgets being reduced because the technology is getting rid of people?
The budgets have been reduced because people don't want to pay the money. But the budget shouldn't have been reduced. Let's say, for example, there was a fashion shoot by whoever, right? So you've got a whatever camera it was, film camera, then the camera was the cost of the camera. Then you've got the cost of the film, blah, blah, blah. You take your pictures. The photographer then would either expose them and get them all processed, or they'd send them off to a lab. They'd do them. That's part one. Now you have a picture. Now we've got pictures, right? Now what do? We need to get this picture into this magazine or onto that poster. So you'd have to scan them. But it's not scanners like we've got now. We do photocopies and everyone's got one in the house. There were these machines called drum scanners, big as this room.
Wow.
They were like £1 million each. Giant drum, almost like an oil barrel, but thinner. You'd mount the pictures onto the drum.
The actual prints.
Physical prints or like transparencies, like 35mm prints, wherever they were, because you blow them up. Yeah. And then there's different processes for different ones. So the actual prints, you'd just mount onto the scanner with tape. They'd spin round super fast, and this little light in there, this little camera would take pictures of it, which was the scan. It would go backwards and forwards like a scanner does now. If it was a transparency, you'd mount them first on a thin layer of oil on a see-through like acetate type thing. You'd put the transparencies on, then you'd cover them with oil again. You'd have to then put another layer of this acetate over the top. You get this brush, which is an anti-static brush, which you could do with brushing yourself and your socks off with, so don't get another shock. You brush all that off, and then you'd look at it under a small magnifying glass. You brush out all the bubbles, then you'd scan it again. They'd go on the drum machine, they'd scan. And you'd have to be like a, I didn't do this because I wasn't a drum scanner, but you'd have to have like a, you'd be shit out of maths, physics, because you'd have to pinpoint the point where you wanted to scan it from here.
Highly specialised job.
Highly specialised. Starts here, they got paid a fortune. Starts here, finishes here, does however many scans per second, gives you the image on a computer, which you then take the image from the computer, design it, put it onto your page layout. Now we'd use InDesign, like you spoke about InDesign before. You use InDesign. Back then it was like Quark or PageMaker.
Yeah, I remember Quark, yeah.
Brilliant. You get this giant box with the box was as big as this table for the software. Now you just download it. So then you'd put it into your page layout. Brilliant. Now what? So now we'd print a PDF, send it off to print. Not in those days, you didn't. You printed it out to a giant machine bigger than this room, which you then produce films. So when you print something, like when we download an image now, it's on RGB, red, green, and blue.
Mm-hmm.
Back in those, but we're still, when you print something that like tangible printed thing, it's CMYK, cyan, magenta, yellow, black. You have to print out films for one cyan, one magenta, one yellow, one
on
black.
On top of each other, like lithographic printing.
Lithographic, exactly like LiFo printing. Then you put it all together and then you'd have your page. So you'd hold it up, you're looking at it, it's all black and white. But when you print that, the cyan is printed in cyan, the magenta is printed in magenta, the yellow is printed in magenta, and the black is printed in black, and then it comes out and it's a physical page. That's how print works, right? So if you think about
that. I mean, you must have done that a few times because you've got a clear memory of that, haven't you? Even though how long ago that must have been.
Well, yeah, and then within there, like things change. So you used to get proofs, right? So when you got to that point, you've got a printed proof, a colour proof, which is called a chromalin. It was just like the brand name of the company that did it. So back when I first started to make these chromalin proofs, you'd expose the cyan, you'd get a tub like your glass of cyan powder, chuck it on, brush it off, and it'd stick to it a little bit like a screen print, right?
Yeah.
Then you'd get the magenta, yellow, black, blah, 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 dust it all off, and then you'd end up with your proof, which you then give to the photographer. They'd just write all over it with pen or pencil. We need to take your bags out. We need to do this. We need to do that. You'd get your retouch instructions. You'd have to do another proof when that was done. So there was this whole process, like a 20-step process.
Just to get it to print.
Before
it's even got to print, wow.
And each bit of that had a monetary cost attached to it.
Yeah.
Now you're going to take a picture of that straight on the computer. You design it yourself. Send the PDF over to me, off to the printer.
So that's closed down all of those little cottage industries that sprung up to service that process.
So many of them died. Like so many of those things died back then. I can't really relate it to anything else because I didn't know anything else that went through it. But I suppose you can almost say, you know, like with Ubers and cabs or whatever. But there was no monopoly for that.
But it's crazy, isn't it, how quick technology develops, how quick we are to take advantage of those new developments in technology to create these little industries where we can where we can generate some money from.
Yeah.
But as quick as they appear, they disappear. I mean, look at the cassette.
Yeah.
Imagine how much money went into creating and developing cassettes.
Yeah.
And then all that promotion that went with them, the Walkman and everything, and all that massive industry that came around for cassettes. And they just disappeared. Yeah. You know, CDs came, same sketch with them, and they disappeared. And now it's just all streaming.
Well, there was about a year that it was mini discs. Remember them?
Yeah, mini discs, yeah.
They didn't last long, but I had one in my car. I had like a 6-disc mini disc change in my car.
But that had the DAT, you remember DAT?
Yeah.
Digital audio tape. You still got the player.
Well, this is what we had back in those times when we back our stuff up. Like now you're going to back up your cameras later.
Yeah.
You plug the memory card, this tiny little thing like this, you plug that in and it's got 256 gigs worth of storage because you can put on a 2 terabyte drive within seconds. Back in those days we had, floppy
disk.
Well, floppy disk was 1 megabyte.
Yeah.
Right?
1 megabyte.
Yeah, 1 megabyte. So then they had like people like us within the industry, there was a thing called a zip drive, which was like a floppy on steroids. So it was like a fatter.
Yeah.
Floppy drive, which was 100 megabytes. At the time, that was like, oh, this is fucking, we're in the future. And then we had these other things that were called like SyQuest drives, and they were this big, and they were like 250 meg, and you'd have to put them into this machine to back all this stuff up. And then like when that era, it was like almost overnight, and that digital era changed, we had like piles of these things. What the fuck did you do with them?
What did you do with them?
Chucked them in a bin.
Yeah.
Because once you backed it up and you're on little DAT drives, you're on tapes, and then all of a sudden it's cloud storage. And other stuff like systems and like the RAID systems or this.
I don't know what to make of it though, because it's like the digitization of our culture, of our history, it kind of obliterates it in a way, doesn't it? Because if it only exists digitally, right, and there is no analog, physical, tangible, record of what we've created, does it exist? Can it be manipulated?
That's the problem for me as a skeptic and as someone who's always got it's the manipulation part, right? Because if it's in a cloud, who can get to it?
Yeah.
It's not just you who can get to it. Like if you think that, you're naive. If you think that all your selfies you're taking and uploading to your cloud.
A cloud just means someone else's computer.
Someone else's system, exactly. Yeah.
I've got a friend who works, provides generators, backup generators,
right,
for data centers,
yeah,
and there's a massive, massive operation going on across Spain, Portugal, Switzerland, Ireland, where they're building these ginormous data centers,
right,
for Microsoft. Microsoft are paying for it. It's not talked about, it's not promoted.
Yeah.
They're taking huge drains upon the national grid, and it's to create these ginormous city-sized data centers, right? Where, you have to have various levels of security pass to get in them, right?
Right.
There's like, the deeper you get in, it's like bloody the Pentagon.
Yeah.
Right, and this is being built to digitize our entire culture, as to run the 5G network, the AI, really interesting stuff, but nobody knows about it. Billions and billions are being spent on it.
The AI stuff's interesting. The one job that come up, I turned it down eventually because it was a bit weird.
Mm.
And it was about, when you're buying something, say you're going to go buy a new pair of trainers,
yeah,
and you go in, you have to move the puzzle piece across, right? And then it asks you a question. Tick the boxes that are bikes, tick the boxes that are bridges. And I always just thought, this is a bit weird test of my skills. You still get it wrong sometimes.
Fucking creative director,
but you still get it wrong though, don't you? You know, like, oh fuck, I clicked the wrong one. But speaking to this guy, what this guy is doing is he's building those, but custom for a brand.
Yeah.
So if you're Nike and you're on a Nike site, it's name each pair of Air Max or name... tick each pair of Air Max 90s.
Custom captures.
Basically, that's what it is. And so I was like, this is interesting, and I can see the reason, the need for it from a client point of view. But what's the, because it was funded by Google. He had some Google money behind him. I was like, so what's the point of it? He said, essentially what you're doing is you're building up the AI's intelligence.
You're training it.
You're training it.
Yeah.
So if it's asking you what's a bridge, it kind of knows what a bridge is, but you're reaffirming what a bridge is. So every time you click on that bridge button, the AI is ticking a box that you're making it more knowledgeable, almost.
Free training.
Yeah, so we're all feeding into it without knowing as well, which is weird, right? It's the same with the map system as well, because ultimately what they want to do is Google want to own the map space and where the, that means where you're going and what you're doing eventually, whatever, wherever weird path that goes in.
Mm.
But you're training up their AI in particular every time you do it. I just thought it was mind-blowing.
What do you think about being somebody who works in the creative space? I do too, because I work with cameras and editing software. And, you know, you'd have to create thumbnails. I'm using graphic design stuff. Is what's your take on where we are heading with this whole AI, right? And there's something that you mentioned to me that I wanted to chat to you deeper about, which was the gentrification of design, or creativity is what you called it, the gentrification of creativity. And I thought that's a really interesting title. I'm sure it's got a lot of, you know, a bottomless pit that yeah. we could talk about for hours, but what's that?
But I kind of go into each other, right? So yeah. like, this is, you get me going now.
Good.
The AI thing, first of all,
yeah,
it's just another tool. You've got to be capable in the first place, which is where the gentrification of creativity comes in. That's my new catchphrase. My other one is, so if you're a freelancer and you're in the freelance pool, as it were, I call it the snake pit of mediocrity because most of them are shit.
Yeah.
And it's a snake pit because they're all climbing over you to get, like, I'll get these LinkedIn messages and people following me and want to contact me because all they really want to do is see what jobs I'm going for so they can jump in and get ahead of me. You know? But so with AI, it's just a tool. And you see people, and you see people getting scared of it. It's just like having Photoshop. If you can't use Photoshop, you might be a little bit scared of it. If you can write a brief, so this is the other thing. Like, you've got all these mid management level people that are giving people like me, who's been in the industry for 20 years, a brief. They've come out of a college 2 years ago, and all of a sudden they want to tell me about marketing and how to market and want to give me a brief, but they don't know what they're talking about, right? Mm. So they can't write a brief. That's point one. If you can't write a brief, you can't brief the AI to give you something that you want to do, right? Yeah. So I believe that I'm quite good at writing a brief or getting to where I want to get to in the creative process. So end product, I can create pretty well with, like, say, Midjourney, for example. I use that quite a bit now.
Wow.
To generate imagery, normally for decks.
What would you do for pitch decks?
Pitch decks.
Yeah.
Because if your pitches, I work for a couple of PR companies.
So sorry to interrupt you. Are you visualizing the end product?
Yeah.
Right, and then you're able to give the client a fully realized a vision of what that end product
is. So with these PR companies, it'll be like they're selling something to Amazon. I did one last night. They won't mind me saying. They did a pitch for Amazon Prime, and they wanted they've got this deck. Giant deck with all these bits and pieces, and they put a mark on there. Oh, we'd like to show a HGV truck with a cinema screen on the side. We're going to drive it up and down the country. So normally that would involve me going to find a picture, photoshopping it, putting some stuff on the side. It might take me an hour or 2 hours. Instead, I can sit there for 10, 15 minutes, mess about in Midjourney and try and spit something out, which is decent, and then chuck it in for the client. Easy. It's Midjourney. It's a low res image. It's not great. You're never going to print it. It's not going to be a poster. It has its capabilities.
It's a guide more than anything.
It's a guide. Yeah. They're going to go build something tangible off the back of it. So it's just another tool. If anything, it makes capable people more effective.
Yeah.
If you're incapable, it's not going to make you any more effective. If anything, it's going to drive you more mad and then get you frustrated that you can't use it. Mm-hmm. And then it becomes a problem because you see other people creating good stuff. And that's when the fear for this AI stuff comes. It's like, oh my God, you're using, I can't use it. And because they're scared of it, they can't use it. And they're worried about it taking over their jobs. And also there's a load of people that...
Well, we've just talked about how technology can decimate and level entire cottage industries as it develops. So yeah. I guess there is an element of truth in AI, you know, decimating other industries. But then again, new jobs and new industries emerge from what the new tech is.
But also, if you listen,
AI engineers, that's all our jobs are going to be.
Anyway, that's what the people are advertising for, a prompt engineer.
A prompt engineer.
Because it's called a prompt. When you write a prompt, it's called a prompt. But I just, it's again, it's like, you know, if you're comfortable in what you're doing, you're heading for a fucking, like, never be comfortable because it can, and that might just be the way you're born or in your bloodline or in your genetics that. Comfortability for me is the worst thing. You should never be comfortable because you don't know what's coming around the corner. And if you don't zig when the industry zags or whatever industry you're in, you're always going to get left behind. Like, I've been in it for 25 odd years. Like,
You told me you'd seen a change like at least three times.
Yeah, it's changed loads of times. Analog to digital, like digital, which was then taken away from the companies producing it and going in-house. Then in-house can't cope with it or they're doing it wrong. So it comes back to outsourcing again.
Yeah.
And then other teams get built around it. And then the structure of design teams and creative teams and different places changes. And you've got to move with it. And if you don't move with it, you get stuck behind. Like there's this one... This new AI thing got announced this week with Sonar or Solar or something, which is a video AI generator.
Mm.
And it's incredible.
Mm.
And they've put all these examples out. It's by what they call OpenAI. Yeah, it's by them. It's really interesting. But they've showed some samples and then they showed the prompts that they got to get to the samples. And it's amazing. Like, if you're pitching a movie, me and you could sit there for a couple of hours, have a couple of beers and go, right, we're going to write a movie. And it's going to be... whatever, say like a Guy Ritchie type movie, right?
Yeah.
We can get perfect 10, 15 second clips that perfectly match up what we're trying to achieve and put them all together, stitch them together and go and present that to a movie company, a 1 minute, 30 second trailer of perfect footage. You can't watch that on your HD TV indoors because it's going to look like shit. It's going to be all flickery. But if you look at that on a TV on a computer screen, it's going to be great. It's just another tool.
So do you think we're going to get to the point though where AI creative tools are better than what humans can create? And therefore, you know, this, because one of the things that defines our humanity, one of the things that separates us from the animals is art, you know, is our ability to create things just for the sake of creating them or to communicate, you know, transcendent messages through symbols and images. And, you know, that kind of defines what it means to be human.
Yeah.
But this machine has appeared that can replicate poetry, not quite at the scale of Yeats. Or now, you know, OpenAI is making videos. Will it compete with Kubrick's movies? You know, where does that lead to? And does that have a dystopian future in which humans lose their humanity and just become like the Borg? I don't know what's.
No, I don't think so. But I might be wrong. Who knows? But I just think that there's a place for it, and I think that because I think there's always room for specialism.
Yeah.
And there always should be. Excuse me. And I think the big problem is almost like a separation, right? I can sit here now with a paintbrush and I can draw a capable picture and you go, oh, that's great, that's brilliant. But you put me next to a full-time artist, they're going to create an amazing job. And I look at that and go, well, that's fucking amazing.
Mm.
It's almost like the separation. Like, okay, well, if you lot are happy with that, and take it, and then it just creates a bigger divide in what you think is good and what isn't, you know, like, and who's accounting for taste? You can't ever the taste makers, like, you can't tell people what's good and what isn't, can you? Like, that's up to them, that's up for them to decide, but it comes down to quality.
And I think also as well, it's like you know, you see AI art comes up in your feed, doesn't it? And you can see it and you know which is the AI art, right? And it gets to the point where I feel as if there's no value to it as a standalone piece, right? Because you know that there was no sacrifice made, no sacrifice taken in the making of that particular art. There was no struggle from the human learning the skills, how to be a painter, all those things. And it just like, that doesn't really have any value. Whereas if it was created by us, by humanity, then there's all of that embedded within the art itself, is knowing what the sacrifice made. So I think it might get to a point where we need to define what's being made by AI and what's being made by the human so that we know where to assign the value to it, the emotional value that we give to art. So I don't think there's an emotional connection to the AI art because we know some fucking robots made it, you know.
There's no soul, heart and soul in it. And you can tell with everything else, like we were saying before, like music or whatever.
Yeah.
If there's no soul in a piece of art you're looking at, you can tell. Even if you take a piece of digital and you print it, and you've got something in your hand, it still doesn't feel like that. You know, look, they tried to attach the monetary thing with the NFT stuff and all that kind of. Yeah. That was just people pissing about making stuff and spitting stuff out. It wasn't. Some people did. It wasn't like Midjourney and DALL-E and all this stuff. That wasn't just them making stuff. A lot of this was like literally digital artists creating stuff digitally, but it just wasn't hitting right.
Yeah,
that's why I always like in my work, it's a mixture. Like, it's your influences as a person.
Yeah.
So it's like graffiti, street, like, it's got to have a bit of grit to it. It's got to feel like it's got a bit of...
Well, that's why they're hiring you, aren't you? For your authenticity, because you're bringing the streets to, you know, these like faceless corporate giants, I guess.
But that's the big thing. So like a friend of mine posted something the other day, because it's award season in the creative industry this couple of months. But what that means is, which agency has paid for the table at the award ceremony, because you're going to get nominated, right?
Right, yeah.
And he was like, oh, I don't know whether I should post this or not. Because he's like, he runs a small creative studio up in Chester. I don't know if I should post this or not. I was like, is it affecting your customer base? Are you going to get less customers off the back of it? He said, well, no, because people probably appreciate that I'm writing this. I was like, right, so what is amongst your industry peers? Do you want to be the same as those people? No, not really. Well, fucking put it out then. What does it matter? Like, start rubbing people up the wrong way. And that's part of that whole thing that we were talking about, the gentrification of it, because it's been taken over by people that are, we've got the money to take over this industry. But there's no fucking passion in it. There's no soul in it. And it's starting to show in the output of the work that comes out of it now as well, you know?
Because you were explaining to me early before we started was about how with this idea of the gentrification of creativity in which it's being monopolized by mediocrity, is that film, music, sport is kind of all merging into one blob
of culture.
Explain what your thoughts are on that, because that really intrigued me and we didn't really delve into it. You just touched on it.
All those as a creative, you just create and you make. And I might decide, actually, I'm going to make a song next week. It's not going to be very good, but it's my expression, so I needed to do it, right? But with that, there comes a lot of stuff in the creative world. So with music, film, blah, 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 and it goes through cyclical turns. And sport, particularly football, because that's where the money is, music and art have kind of molded into one. And we're starting to see it with film as well now. Like, we're starting to see these, like Top Boy, and Drake has executive produced Top Boy because he's attaching himself to the culture.
There's loads of crossover.
All this crossover is going across all over the place, right? But when you think about, like, where does it come from? Where's the next revolution come from? Because all of a sudden everything starts to look the same and feel the same, and there's no difference. There's no differentiation. And like we were saying before, like, music, and you've got rock and roll and all these amazing.
Well, where's it gone?
It's gone. But then, like, because it's one of my, I love Arctic Monkeys. Alex Turnoff is one of the best frontmen, UK frontmen ever, and he'd done that speech when they won the Brits. You know, that rock and roll, it just goes away, but the cyclical nature of it is it comes back, and it's always there, just waiting to come out of the. And I think that's what happens. It's like, the dilution of anything creative that you're making, it becomes very flat. Like, if you think of it as a chart, it's just very flat. So films the same, music's the same, all the songs you turn on the radio, all sounds the same. And then all of a sudden something comes out of it, like grime come out of music. All of a sudden there's this aggressive, like, street music come out of London, predominantly like Birmingham's inner city places, and it starts to expand and expand and expand and expand. And all of a sudden you've got some posh white kid who's trying to emulate it and trying to do the same thing, but it's inauthentic. And that's the ways that, like, we spoke about this briefly, but authenticity across anything, like, it doesn't matter whether I'm talking about design, I'm talking about life. Like, me and you, the way we talk to each other.
Yeah.
I know you talk to your missus in the same way I talk to mine. And I've got friends who are like, oh, hello, darling. And they're a different person. It's inauthentic.
Yeah.
You're keeping up that lie.
Yeah.
And that's what's infiltrating, like, creativity. It drives me fucking insane.
Well, I think it's a really good point, and I totally agree with it, because you can see it, can't you? It's just a blob. And it's like pop has just taken over the whole Simon Cowell phenomenon, has spread across every industry, hasn't it? And it's just, what can we spit out next? Because it's easy to create a pop star. It's not easy to create a Jimmy Page. Yeah. You know,
it's formulaic.
It's formulaic, but it's making them the dough. So while it's making them the dough, they'll always keep doing it. But it reminded me of, we went to a party at Christmas. It was in Duskers, and it was an amazing party. I really, really enjoyed it. All the kids went, and one thing blew my mind. It just totally blew my mind, right? My lad Donnie was playing around, and I went to find him. And I went into the kids' bedroom, and all the kids were playing, and there was a record deck, a vinyl record deck. The kids were nine, right? And they were looking at each other's vinyl. It's going, what the hell is going on? Have I just gone back to the future? Have I just went back to 1988, walked in, and these kids are into vinyl? And I come out and said to you, what the hell's going on in that bedroom? They're listening to vinyl? You went, that's what, they've all got their own record deck and they're trading records. What? That for me was like, it's not over.
Yeah.
And this is the cyclical nature.
Yeah.
And this is kids saying, no, we want something tangible. We want to hold it. We want to feel it. We want to touch it. We want to...
And it's not just the music either. Like, my two eldest have both got record players, and they're both into vinyl. So if they ever get any money, they want to go and buy a new record.
Yeah.
But then off the back of that, they're forming, number one, they're forming their own music tastes.
Wow.
Like the eldest one, like he got into, weirdly got into MF Doom. That's not something as a rap fan you walk into. You have to seek that out. It's quite specific in like its sound. But around him, he's got this whole culture of art, and he's got graffiti background, and he wears this mask, and there's this whole stuff that goes with it. And there's like, he can go back and look at 20 years of history and 20 years of vinyl and go back and find out about this stuff. So it's almost like the search for knowledge that he's going down a path. And the youngest one, like, he's into Eminem and like other stuff, but he just
Eminem on vinyl.
Yeah, on vinyl, yeah. He's got Eminem on vinyl. But just like, they find their own little thing, and they realize, yeah, when you open this, or you keep on opening it, it's got 8 pages. Oh, there's a poster in there.
Yeah.
There's this, like, he's into gorillas as well. And gorillas as a concept is one of the greatest creative concepts of all time. Brilliant. We've got a band here made up of 6 cartoon characters that you don't really know who they are. Like, we know now that they've got real people attached to them, but there's this whole world that's been created around fictional characters and this musical. But
there's no denying that Spotify is an amazing development in musical technology, right? It's now you've got every song ever written at your fingertips, right? But that's great as a convenience, and that's great in being able to find the best stuff and listening to the stuff that you'd really like. But you lose the mixtape aspect. You lose, you know, sharing vinyl. You lose opening them up and seeing the lyrics in there. And that's amazing that kids have naturally gone back to that without being prompted by the parents. The parents haven't even got a record deck anymore. I don't have any vinyl, right? But the kids, off their own volition, are seeking it out. And it gave me really gave me a boost, you know, with this dystopian future. Yeah. And the kids are making those decisions.
It's cool.
Themselves.
We went up to Lisbon.
Rock and roll will never die.
No, it won't. We went up to Lisbon and we were in a record shop, and Sonny, my 7-year-old, wanted to get a particular vinyl. I can't remember. It was a Daft Punk one he wanted, because he's into Daft Punk. He likes that electro sound. He makes music on his iPad now as well.
Like, so is he seeking these vinyls out?
He finds them. So he was flicking through and he found one and he put it to the side, and the guy come over and was like, "This Portuguese, what the fuck?" He said, "I'll put it on the counter for you, come get him." And he's like, "Okay, thank you." And then he's like, "Oh, I want to get this one instead." And I said, "Well, go tell the man you want to swap it over." He went over and like the guy was like, "This is amazing." He said, like, the kids, number one, he's found the vinyl he wanted. Then he's realised, actually, I don't want that one. I want the other one, because it's got songs that he knows on it. He's like, "We don't really see a lot of that here." I'm like, "Yeah, well, it's cool, isn't it?" But then there's the juxtaposition, right?
Really?
Because he's listening to vinyl, but then he's on his iPad making music in GarageBand.
Yeah.
So he's got a digital drum, he's got a digital guitar, a digital organ with all these things at his fingertips, and he tries to replicate the sounds that he's hearing so that he can make it himself. Now, if I'm going to go and buy him a guitar and a drum kit, it's going to cost me 12 grand to get him all the stuff that's on this 500 quid iPad.
Yeah.
But he's trying to replicate it. I don't know, there's something cool about that.
No, there is, yeah, because it's like, that's what I'm saying, is that the digital tools are incredible, right? The digital tools are amazing. I love them myself.
Yeah.
But we shouldn't lose touch with the analog and the real and the tangible. And that's fantastic to see them doing that. It was really something that gave me a buzz.
Yeah.
It really gave me a buzz.
But design should always start with a pencil, I always think.
Yeah.
Well, number one, the idea, they used to call it the back of a fag packet idea, right? Because you write it down at the back of a fag packet in the pub. You go, right, let's go down to the pub for lunch in Soho somewhere, write down a load of ideas on the back of the cigarette box that you've just smoked, and then you come back and then you start, right, we're going to need a logo, we need this, and it starts with a piece of paper and a pencil, and you start sketching stuff out, and then you make that digital, and it's just sharpen it up and sharpen it up and sharpen it up every time, you know? That's what I used to
do. But it's like, as well as, so I used to make music videos back in a previous life, right? I was a lot younger, and I wasn't as grey, I've still had it, right? But anyway, that's in the past. But I used to love making music videos. I used to love making films and videos. And what was different back then for me, because I had a bit of a gap, what was different was that it was still a little bit elitist, that whole industry. And I just kind of hustled my way in, right? And then I'm mixing with like middle class kind of people who like, "What's he doing here? Yeah. Well, how did he get in? You know, how did he get past the gate?"
Yeah.
But what I found was, is that when I was making music videos and directing them, I didn't touch any kit. I didn't touch any of the technology, you know, the editing, the cameras. Yeah. I just directed the show, right? Yeah. Because I didn't know how to
use a good creative director should,
right? But I didn't know how to use the kit, right? That's what it was, because it was like it was 16mm cameras, film cameras, and you had to be a highly specialist cinematographer to know how to use the kit.
Yeah.
And it was too distant. It was away, but it was at the, when I kind of moved out of that industry, the technology was just about reaching the mass market.
Yeah.
I took a few years out, came back in, I'm doing the podcast now, and now all of the kit has been democratized to the point where we can afford high quality, video making equipment.
Yeah.
And, you know, you have to learn how to use it yourself now because it's there, it's at your fingertips. Is that part of, how does that fit into your vision of this, you know, gentrification of creativity mixed with the democratization of technology? Anyone can go out and film stuff now. So, you know, quantity is an issue, isn't it?
It's changed a bit again, right? So you still have to, if you're going to do a big shoot for, like I did a job for North Face and JD Sports, right?
Yeah.
So we work out our plan, we've got, then I hire a DOP, a director of photography, who's going to tell us, I tell him, I want a shot like this. He goes, right, you're going to need a 16 mil this and, blah, 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 and all the camera, all the gear. He knows what to do to create what I think we should have, right? So on a big shoot like that with a bigger budget, you've still got all of that at hand. If not, and you're shooting something differently, you've got to go and try and work it out yourself. So, for example, I've got one of my cousins, he's a music producer, but then he sort of zigged and zagged and he makes a lot of rap music. He's in the middle of East London. He's around all these rappers. He's got these cool Latino rappers and all these people. And he started making music videos. So he went and bought himself like a decent camera with a couple of really good lenses. The lenses cost more than the cameras. He charges these kids, like they're street kids, he charges them 5-10 grand a video. And they've got the money. He's doing one or two a week sometimes.
Wow.
You know, he's making a fucking good living shooting these videos. And he's got, you look at the quality of it, and it's better than these 90s music videos from MTV. So in a way, like, that's great because you've got that entry level into it. But then...
That's what I'm saying. It's like, it's available to everybody now.
Whereas, it's available if you've got the money. There's still a monetary thing.
There's still a monetary thing, but it's not like when I was directing music videos, like, you couldn't get that level of equipment. You could get like prosumer, but the quality wasn't there. But as now, I can go and get a Sony A7 C2 and I'm getting close to, you know, as film good quality. A quality as you can get.
There's also
I can get one for $2,000, you know?
There's also these amazing companies. Like we used to have a photography business and videography business along with another, like you say, another world. I just had a core base of cameras and equipment. But then there's a company called Hire a Camera, for example, and there's a load of others.
Yeah.
Whatever you want. You want Red Dragon, whatever, you go hire it. Mm. It's going to cost you £1,500 a day. You just pass that cost on to the client. So rather than me having to go and spend $100,000 on a camera and $50,000 on each bit of glass that you go with it, I'm going to hire it all for $2,500 for the day and then go shoot with it. You just need to find someone who knows how to use it properly.
That's the problem.
But then the other difference now is we're going out, so deliverables. Like it always used to be, right, we need a 1 minute, 30 second film, advertisement. It's going to go out on our channels, our website. It's going to go on YouTube or whatever. Everything now has got to be filmed that way. Because it's all for social, it's all for TikTok. So now people are spending...
Can you film it in vertical, please?
That's exactly that. And you see the people got their cameras now. They're like, you know, they're filming everything vertical, which is a whole different skill in itself because people that are learning how to...
It's an alien aesthetic as well, isn't it? Especially to filmmakers. Like, what do you mean vertical? I want to do 1, 2, 3, 5.
Yeah. And you see like people that have learned how to be a videographer.
Yeah.
They've gone through whatever they've gone through to do it. And then you put them on a set and they go, right, do you know what? We've got to shoot this vertical. And their brains pop out because there's no like history of teaching you how to shoot that way. Framing is like, if you can frame it right, you can get away with anything. It doesn't matter what, you can film with.
But isn't it mad that, you know, that entirely new aesthetic that has entered into the video lexicon, which is vertical video making, exists solely because that's the way you hold the phone?
Well, I think what's more interesting is the fact that you can't adapt. So I've made a living off of being able to adapt to whatever happens. I think people that come in that are trained, I've never trained. I talk myself, I sit on other people's shoulders watching people. Because I wasn't trained, I'm not conditioned. So it's like, right, we need to do that. All right, cool, let's work it out. How do we do it? Whereas people now, they look and they go, what do you mean vertical? I've learned for 5 years, I've learned how to shoot everything horizontal. You blow their mind.
Yeah.
You know,
yeah.
Like there's no adaptation because they're just programmed robots. They're just doing as they're told, you know?
Yeah, but it's funny the way it's going, isn't it? Because if you're not able to shoot vertical, you're just going to get left behind.
Yeah.
And there's an app at the moment on the iPhones called the Blackmagic camera app.
Blackmagic cameras,
and they've set the app up in a way that
the cropping.
It's in a landscape format. So even though you hold your phone up in vertical, the default is they're saying, no, we're filmmakers. It's going to be in landscape, so you have to press a button in the settings to change it to vertical. Yeah.
Well, I mean, you still see big.
But it was from a purist kind of perspective that Blackmagic have brought that to the table. Yeah.
I like when that happens. Like, we're not going to adapt. This is how we do. Like, so many big companies now still.
Well, they've adapted to the phone. But
they post a story, and before it starts, it says rotate your phone. Brilliant. Okay, cool. We'll.
Yeah.
Okay. Because it's made that way. That's how it should be viewed.
So it's directing you how to view the content.
You are not meant to be viewing it on this phone.
Yeah.
You're meant to be viewing it somewhere else, but it's interesting, isn't it?
Yeah. But another thing we connected on, and I guess probably this is where you source a lot of your inspiration, because to be a creative director, you'd have to have your sources in order to, you know, generate ideas and stuff. And your love for Japan, right? And my love for Japan and Japanese culture. And, you know, I've been to Tokyo, Nagasaki, Osaka, and my father was into Japan, right? And so I always grew up around, like, what's this place? And it was always so fascinating to me, the way they treat everything as an art.
Yeah.
And, you know, they put do on the end, way of, bushido, aikido, all that stuff. When they put a do on the end, it's like a way of. And it was, I realized the life ambition going to Japan, and we were following the darkness around. You know, I remember that mockumentary, Justin Hawkins. We were following him around the world and ended up in Tokyo, like Osaka. It was great. And I filmed a couple of music videos there, one for Dead 60s, which was really good. But how did you end up falling in love with Japan? And tell us a little bit about your experience there, because you've been, haven't you, as well?
A couple of times. And the kids are desperate to go again.
Yeah.
There's like a weird, everything like that I do from my job, like from a creative point of view, it comes from like, you've got to be inspired to do it, haven't you? You know? Mm. And weirdly, there's probably like two weird inspirations that sat in the back of my subconscious that I didn't really know about, which was both my nans, right? So one of them was like an old, I say old, obviously they're old women nans, but one of my nans had like a charity shop. She was like a very glamorous old Jewish lady, always had like these fake diamond earrings. Her hair was always jet black, even though it's probably grey underneath all the dye. Always a big fluffy jumper, just very glamorous. So we used to go around when I was a kid, 3 or 4, I remember getting on a bus with her, and we used to go around to all these jumble sales, and she used to buy like all the cool jumpers and things like that. And then she used to like put some like diamonds and stuff on and put some bits on. And then she had like a, what we'd now call like a charity shop or a thrift store. And then she'd go and put them in her shop and then sell them. And that was on, it was in Hackney, down the back of Homerton Hospital. It's really cool now, and a very hipstery place where you can buy avocado on toast for 15 quid. You know?
But back then, more grown here, by the way. Exactly, it's a Hoxton.
Yeah, exactly. But back then, it weren't really the done thing. Now there's like these shops everywhere, right?
Yeah.
So that stuck in the back of my brain. There was always this fashion thing in the back of my brain. And then my other nan was like, she was just a nutcase. And every time you'd go there, she'd have a different colour hair, she'd have her nose pierced, she'd have a parrot on her shoulder that someone didn't want a parrot no more, so she took it in. There was a dog, a cat, fucking donkey, zebra. Like, there'd always be another waif and stray in my nan's house. But all around her flat was Japanese art everywhere.
Wow.
And that must have just stuck. Yeah, because she was like, she was a really good artist.
Okay.
She never had any training, but she liked to paint and stuff. You know?
Hokusai wave kind of...
Yeah, you know, like you see like these geisha girls, almost like... tattoo style, like when you see these amazing Japanese tattoos, like it was almost that,
like
kind of
Yakuza
stuff,
you know?
Yeah, you know, like when they have a full body suit and you've got like an amazing, and the whole idea of it is, you know the idea, you know, the point of like Bushido, they call, you know, the art of Japanese tattooing is that there's a journey through your body, right? So when you see this whole body suit, you start as a fish. So if you ever see a koi carp at the top of someone's body, they're probably imbalanced. For example, my dad, who's very imbalanced, has got a koi carp on his shoulder, because a koi carp should start lower. This might be wrong, but this is what I was told.
Yeah.
Starts at the bottom of the journey, because a koi swims upstream. As it swims upstream, it gathers strength and turns into a dragon. Once it turns into a dragon and it goes into battle or whatever, it it dies, it becomes a phoenix and rises again, and the whole cycle starts again. And she had all this kind of stuff, like phoenixes and dragons and geisha girls around, which was just weird for a flat in Bow in East London.
So it was like it juxtaposed. You
don't know where she got it from.
I was going to say, where did this love of Japan from?
No idea where she got it from, but that must have just always stuck in the back of my brain. I think like with men and groups of men, when you grow up, you tend to gather in a group, don't you? And then you go your separate ways. I very early on in my group of friends, it became evident that I was different. I didn't wear the same clothes as people. I didn't like the same stuff as people. And it started to, there was like a bit of a separation there, you know? And then all of a sudden I made the decision, actually, I'm going to wear whatever the fuck I want, do whatever the fuck I want. And it was at the beginning, like before trainers were like super popular, sneaker culture, there was like, it was almost like it was like an underground culture. And there was this forum, excuse me, it's called Crooked Tongues. It was all trainer collectors from all over the world, but largely it was like a UK thing. So all of a sudden you're talking to this guy in Birmingham who buys, he only buys like New Balance, and no one had New Balance. He had like 20 pairs of New Balance. And there's one guy in London who works for Nike and got all this other stuff. And it was like this really underground thing. And then I was like before I was 20, like the turn of the 2000s, I discovered, off the back of trainer culture, I discovered streetwear and all these brands in streetwear and graffiti and this London graffiti scene. And I got into UK hip hop, which I didn't even know existed. I thought hip hop was from New York. I just thought that's where it was from, or from America. And all of a sudden I found out about this whole culture in the UK, which I didn't know existed. So I really got into it, which is where like the inspiration, the creative inspiration comes from. Because all of a sudden you realise, there's graffiti writers here, there's people making cool music, there's people that dress cool. And then like, as you get a little bit older, I can't wear all the trainers and stuff all the time, because you start to feel like, oh, this isn't a bit like, you're going out to different places, you're not allowed in pubs with trainers in them days, you can't go into certain pubs. But then like these people started to post things like nice denim, like they're wearing, you start posting pictures of what shoes you're wearing today and all this stuff, right? And it's like, that's really, those like, jeans and eyes, what's that? And you start learning about different types of denim and the selvedge and all this stuff and how the denim's made. And then you go, all right, and then where's that made? It's in Japan. Mm. And all of a sudden you start to see this whole Japan thing starts to come back in. And then there was this brand called Visvim that came kind of out of nowhere. This Japanese guy made this stuff, and he was obsessed with, still around now, it's amazing stuff, so fucking expensive now. He's obsessed with Americana and American culture and culture of like Native Americans and different tribes and the way they used to make clothing. So he would go and source crazy materials from the US and then make these handmade shoes and stuff out of them. And I like fell in love with the aesthetic of these shoes. And then from there, like it's just like,
That was your route into Japan.
That was Japan. Like it was like Japanese clothing. And but I'm big.
But they've got an amazing talent for absorbing another culture's ideas, but regurgitating it into something original and something of their own. I mean, right across the board, whether it's filmmaking with Akira Kurosawa or whether it's Toyota and creating the whole lean manufacturing movement, which is expressed in design now as agile, you know, all that stuff that comes from Toyota, you know, and then you've got the design and the music, and it's just whiskey. Look what they're doing with whiskey. Yeah. The guy who invented Japanese whiskey basically went to university in Glasgow as a university student, went on a tour of the whiskey distilleries in Scotland, took notes, went back to Japan and created the whiskey distilleries in Japan, which are still the same as they are today. Yeah. And now Japanese whiskey is, you know, pushing Scotch to be up there with the best. Well, they're amazing how they do it.
They do it as well. And it's not ever a way to like, we're going to do this better and take over.
Mm.
It's all about, like when you go to Japan, so you eventually get there, and you go to these places, these shops and these brands that you never thought you'd go to because you've seen it, you've bought something.
Yeah, goggle eyes like that,
You bought something online, but you realise I'm 6'2" and I'm fat and that stuff don't fit me. It's made for Japanese people, so I just stick to the shoes. I just stick to the jackets because they fit. But you start going, walking around, and you see everyone as, you know, like you walk around London and people have like crazy watches and stuff, and they have all these, like, everyone in Japan has got a black Rolex Submariner on. That's it. Why? You know, this is the perfect watch. I can dress it up, dress it down. I can go out. I can go in the water. I can dive. I can do it because it's made the best. It's the best. That's, everything's the best. And then you walk down the street and what is that? It's a pencil shop. They only have pencils, but they have every kind of pencil you can, from A to B to H to everything, up and down, made of different things, different colours, different materials. And then, I thought, well, that's weird. And the next shop, it's a candle shop. And then it's a knife shop. And then there's a fork shop over the road. They just take something and there is a word for it. It becomes obsession.
Mm.
And it's just like, we have to make the best version of this we can.
Mm. Oh, but they don't get bored, do they? No. It's like, you know, we'd go, okay, I've got pencils. Now I want pens. Now I've got pens. Yeah. Let's get some paper.
Yeah.
You know, let's bring in computers. And the next thing, you've got a superstore, haven't you? Yeah. Whereas they go, no, I want to be the best pencil maker.
And they sustain their business off the back of that as well. Yeah. Because, well, you're going to go to the best, aren't you?
Yeah. It's weird as well because, you know, in the West, we would really regard hyper order or hyper-organization as being cool, right? But whereas the Japanese are able to marry this hyper-organized, hyper-ordered society, but yet still have this, like, real fucking cool about them.
Yeah.
I think it's a really unusual dichotomy. I think that's what, you know, we can be attracted to. Because there's a bit of a nerdy side to them, isn't there, as well? I remember going to a rock festival. The bands I was in Japan with, I was going to a rock festival, Summer Sonic, I think it was called, Japanese festival. And all the festivals I've been to at this point involve people being absolutely smashed in the field, surrounded by the detritus of the party. It's like 4 or 5 days of like moving your hand through, you know, sweaty socks and bottles of disused whiskey or whatever.
But, glasses of piss flying everywhere.
Yeah, right. But in Japan, when the gig ended, I've never seen anything like it. Right? When the gig, they all cleaned up their own rubbish. So once everyone left, it was like they'd never been there. It was like they'd never been there at all. And it was like this aspect of their psyche, which is, you know, I don't know whether it's respect for each other, whether it's fear of the
retribution or whatever,
or of the, you know, of the Borg, that they've got a little bit of the Borg going on. Yeah. Or is this element of like not losing face or having shame within the culture?
I think it's the shame thing, because when you go there and people can't talk to you, can't talk to them, and they can't talk to you. And I said this to you. First of all, you think, we thought, like, are they ignoring me? Are they being rude? Because it gets to a point where you're trying to communicate with someone and they're just like this. But then you realise, no, it's because they have shame in not being able to communicate with you in your language. I mean, your country. Mm. You shouldn't have to communicate with me in my language.
But they still understand hospitality, don't they, at that level?
But it'll be that I'd rather than talk to you and disrespect myself by not being able to communicate, I'm going to not talk to you. So come this way or come that way, but I'm not going to even try and engage with you. And I think there's something really nice about that.
Mm.
Like, you know, like just from a...
humanity, you know, basic humanity. I mean, don't get me wrong, they've got a really amazing culture and humanity, but they've got a cruel streak as well, which they demonstrated during the Second World War.
They're like, poof. They're warrior culture.
Yeah, yeah, they're warrior culture, yeah.
And I think that's another thing, because I've done all these weird and wonderful treatments and random stuff I've done over the years, like therapies and stuff like that.
Mm.
And the one thing that always comes back is that you're a warrior.
Mm.
Like, you're somewhere in your lineage, there's warrior in there somewhere, which is hard to believe when you're dressed up in Japanese denim and putting pomade in your hair. But it's like, there is something in you.
Well, look at samurais, how well dressed they were. Those guys were with the hair, the kimono.
But
and
I think
the
that's
sword.
Another thing, you know, like, there's another thing in that culture that you respect, because it's like a quiet killer, you know, like. Just keep pushing me in and see what happens. You know, like, I think there's a bit of that to him.
Well, there was a YouTuber, don't know the guy's name, Somalian YouTuber, American Somalian, and he was in Japan, and he was testing Japanese patience and hospitality to its limit. So he was confronting Japanese on the street, right? I'm embarrassing them and humiliating them and, you know, prodding them and doing and going, watch these guys, they won't do anything. This is going on for weeks and weeks, right? And he's sending these videos back to the West. They're going viral and people saying, this is going to come back bad for you, right? And he kept pushing them and prodding them and really, really humiliating these Japanese people. And the Japanese didn't know what to do. They didn't know how to handle it, because it was such a pattern interrupt to how they understand how to interact with each other that they were just like frozen by it, until word got out and it got sent to some level of samurai up in the society or some level of yakuza, and they came down, they got this kid, this famous YouTuber, gave him a bit of a hiding.
Good.
And he arrested them and they put him in jail for 5 years.
Because yeah. when did that become entertainment? And that's part of the problem about this whole creativity thing and the watering down and the dilution of it.
Okay.
Because everyone copies each other.
Yeah.
So they see Jake Paul got famous from years ago from pissing about and winding people up on these prank videos. Well, number one, it's not funny.
Mm.
But number two, everyone's doing it. So where does it become good or clever? Like you see, I think that even that world's starting to implode on itself.
Good, it needs to, because everyone who was watching those videos of that guy humiliating the Japanese all wanted what him happened to, be, to him.
Yeah, they wanted him to
happen. Yeah, everyone was willing it on. It was like, come on, guys, nick him, get him off the street.
So when do you become someone who's consuming it as content, or when do you become a voyeur? It's like with what they always used to say about Floyd Mayweather with boxing.
Mm.
No one liked him. He was a heel, right? So people used to watch him because they wanted to watch him get beat, but he never got beat.
Yeah.
So you become a heel. It's like with WWE, whatever it's called now, FE, whatever. You've got heels and you've got the, what they call a good guy?
What's a heel?
A heel is the bad guy, the pretend bad guy.
Okay.
So you know The Rock, who's a big famous TV star? Yeah. When he was in wrestling, he was a heel. So that's the bad guy, the instigator. He'll come and try stuff. So there's a heel. I can't remember what the name for the good guy is, but they'd have the...
But that's really interesting that you'd call Floyd Mayweather the heel, because that's exactly what he was. No one supported him because there was nothing really to, you know, get behind with this guy. But
you tune in to watch him get beat.
But he'd never get beat.
Yeah. And you look at the numbers and it adds up.
Yeah.
There's people like Canelo now who just win. The numbers start dwindling. Mm. But then people replicate it. So like in UFC, you've got people pretending to be the heel. Pretending to be this fake bad guy.
Interesting.
But they're not that person. Yeah. But then they've got to live with it. All of a sudden they've taken on this persona. Mm. It's just weird, isn't it?
Mm.
And that's part of that whole thing, isn't it? Because it works somewhere else.
But WWE, Vince Vaughn, no, not Vince Vaughn, the guy who owned WWE, forget his name.
Vince McMahon,
right? Haven't they just done a partnership with UFC?
Well, they're all owned by... is it either it's Endeavor or WME, whichever they are? They're all owned by the same person now.
But doesn't that give you a little bit of insight? To
it's
say,
crossover, yeah.
But how can you have a crossover between worldwide wrestling and UFC? UFC is meant to be serious, right? And meant to be, you know, real competition. Whereas we know that the WWE is completely fixed and staged.
It's not just that they own everything. It's Disney.
Yeah, but doesn't that imply that UFC might be getting staged as well?
I think they're looking at stuff off. Listen, if you know anyone who fights and you look at anyone, a boxer, MMA fighter, anyone who's ever been inside a cage, anyone that does jiu-jitsu, no one's going there to lose, never. And you'd have to pay them a lot of money to throw it. And also, you can see it if you're going to throw it, you know? Mm. Like, hopefully you're going to speak to Colin at some point, and he'll tell you all about that. He'll go deep on it. Because no one's going, you don't train like that. I did a 6-week MMA course and I was fucked every time I did it, you know? Like, there's no way you're training for 3-4 months in a camp every day, training like that, getting punched in the head to lose.
But Paul Smith, you know, the Liverpool comedian, God bless him, he put himself through that kind of level of training.
And he was looking good.
And he was looking really good.
He got a punch in the head.
Yeah, but it was over pretty quick, wasn't it? It shows you how quickly, you know.
But also, it's like he's 15 years younger than him, who's in good shape.
Yeah, give it a good effort.
But yeah, that's a perfect point.
Mm.
Disney own all of that.
Mm.
So they own the WWE, they own UFC. UFC now owns that power slap thing, which is a load of nonsense, people slapping each other. Like, they own it all, so it's like a monopolization.
Well, what's what you're saying, isn't it? The gentrification of creativity, which all becomes one blob.
Yeah.
There is no individuality, because ultimately the people who are running Disney determine what is the output. They determine what the content is. It's whether it makes them more dollar. That's what it comes down to.
And that's what it's down to. It's down to dollar bills at the end of the day. And then... even with like a business like that, like the power slap one, for example, right?
Mm.
So there's just two big fat geezers standing there slapping each other. So it's like arm wrestling.
I can't watch
it.
Oh,
it's terrible. Yeah. But they're getting maybe 300 people in for a live event. So they're not taking a lot of gate money.
Yeah.
They can't be paying the performers a lot of money, but they're getting loads of views, right? Because what they do is they send a load of influencers there to watch it.
Yeah.
Gets posted all over the place and they're getting money off the views. So they're getting money on the back end off of the advertising from their views and from whatever, like, you know, all that works. So they've set up this, I don't want to call it a sport, they've set up this thing just to get views. And it's attached to something else that is potentially got like more kudos to it. So, you know, we're attached to UFC, they're real fighters. We're owned by the same company, but it's not. Mm. Which is why now you're seeing other companies like... BKB, bare knuckle boxing, starting to come up. UFC tried to buy it and made an offer a couple of weeks ago. They turned it down. You've got One Championship, which is like the Asian arm, which they do like, it's not just MMA, it's kickboxing, Muay Thai, they do, or K1, all different types of rules, all different types of fighting. They have these amazing cards that get the best fighters from all over the world. They do these different types of competition. You're starting to see competition now coming into those areas, which is really...
You need it, yeah.
Yeah, it's interesting. Like, yeah. You do start to see in different arenas like where it starts to be pushed a little bit, you know?
That's one of the areas you've kind of specialised in over the years is sport.
Yeah.
You know, one of the areas that, you know, you're kind of dominating, right? But... Interestingly, we were chatting about this. We were chatting about, you know, your roots through, you know, your career and stuff. And there was a period that interests me, right, which was when you were working for the FA and working under one of LFC's greatest managers of all time, Roy Hodgson, when he was, you know, given the downgrade from Liverpool to England. You know, and I remember, you know, one of the best chants ever from the cop was Hodgson for England. Our old manager.
Get rid of him,
send him to England. And that's exactly where he went.
Exactly.
Yeah. So, you were working at the FA during that period, and you were, you know, designing the marketing and some of the branding that we know today, or we remember, especially if you're my age and you were watching football back then. I think football itself is a really interesting topic to cover about where we're heading with football, how it's changed over the years. And you've kind of been behind the scenes during a lot of that transformation. Tell us a bit about your time at the FA.
I went to the FA as head of design. So that's basically what that means, is like looking after the design team. So when I first went there, it was a small team of, I don't know, three or four people. And you just, if someone within the business needed something designed or you needed something to come to them, they'd bang it out. But there was a couple of, like, a friend of mine was running the comms team, which is like responsible for contact with newspapers and then all the social media stuff. Like, it was at the turn of when social media was coming bigger, you know, probably 10 years ago. So the idea was, right, we're going to build this whole big team here. We're going to blast the numbers up on social. We're going to make some really cool shit. We're going to disrupt it a little bit, shake it up a little bit. It's a governing body. It's boring. On paper, it's a boring place. It's, you walk in there, it's soulless. The office was inside Wembley Stadium. You'd walk into the gates where you'd normally walk. Like, it's where all the prawn sandwich brigade walk in. You walk in the big gates, you go up the thing, past all the boxes, and you go through a security door, and then you're in the office, the FA offices, which are behind the south stands. Big screen, a big digital screen. That's where the offices are. Then my office was off to the side with our little design team in it. So we ended up growing the little design team from like four people into like eight full-time staff and about 10 freelancers. And we were literally doing everything from creating like email signatures and triplicate receipt books for the accounts team or for whatever, you know, to doing the graphics for the World Cup. When you go to the hotel, to make the team feel like they're not in France, they make them feel like they're at home. You decorate the whole hotel with England branding all over from top to bottom. So they feel like they're at St George's Park, which is the England training centre where England train up near Derby. So they always feel like they're a little bit home from home. So like everything with anything that goes out to the public facing that had any kind of design element to it would come through like my team. And we started doing some cool stuff and some interesting stuff. Some stuff that we weren't really meant to do. So like part of the job is to like create the brand guidelines. So you must stick within this when you're going out to public. So you've got colours, you've got logos, you've got this, you've got that. But we're going out on social media. So like traditional brand guidelines don't really apply when you're going out on social because you're just trying to shake things up a bit and be different to other people. So we kind of went a little bit rogue and started doing some cool stuff. Like we went and made, it was at the time Rooney had just broken the goal scoring record. So there
early 2000s was that?
Mate, I don't know.
It's
got to be like 10 years ago-ish. Yeah. And it must be about 10 years ago. Yeah. It just broke the goal scoring record. Now, tradition was is when you break the goal scoring record, you have a photograph taken. You come in, you get a commemorative cap and you do this stuff. You do something. And they put the picture up in the halls of Wembley. So when you go into the England end, which I think is a north end, I might be wrong. When you go into, you see the picture of all the top goal scorers as you walk down, it's like, you know, Gary Lineker, blah, blah, blah. There's all these pictures, Bobby Charlton, blah, blah, blah. The picture people are standing like that. What can we do different? So we hired this graffiti artist, this unknown graffiti artist, a little bit like Banksy.
For the FA.
Yeah. It's called Axe P19, really cool guy. He's got like, you would have seen his work. He does loads of stuff up in Manchester. He's always like a really photorealistic face. He does them everywhere. He's done the Marcus Rashford one. You see that when he did the school meals?
Yeah.
So we got him to do a giant canvas as big as this wall of Rooney's face, and then we just done like a really cool video around it, and then we hung it up. It's hanging up in Wembley now. So we got something up on the walls of Wembley, like tangible and all that. Cool. We made a giant flag, the biggest flag. They call them TIFOs now, don't they? So these giant, they do a lot of it in America. Giant flag that the fans held up, which had 50,000 tweets that we'd printed onto this picture all across the whole thing. Just started to do like some random stuff like that. It was really cool. Like we started to shake it up a bit, and it kind of molded where England have gone. They produce, England actually produced really nice output now for everything. But at the time, we would just set up FATV, which now is its own beast. It's good. They've got a whole studio and a whole system. And the guys that are still there now are like giving talks on how to set up a studio system for sport and how to film for sport and how to. It was like the start of something really cool. And then it got to a point where it was like the FA had to make up a deficit of 180 million quid. I can't remember. It was something to do with building the stadium.
It was that Carillion scandal, think it was connected to. It was, they'd run out of money or they couldn't pay the bill.
They ran out of money, couldn't pay the bill, so they had to claw back 180 million quid. So they started to look at the business, where can we save money? I'd already asked for, like, we're doing loads of work. I need a couple more people. I might need a couple of hundred grand here for, like, four more people. They're like, no, wait. Anyway, they decided, because what I'd done with the design team was, being just a couple of designers that serviced the business, I'd attached an internal recharge to each piece of design work that I could then track so I can monitor performance, because it's the second time I've worked within a big corporate company, because that's what it is, it's a corporation. Excuse me. And I thought, right, I know what you people are like. You're going to try and fuck me at one point or another. Whether I ask for some more people to come and work for me, or if I need something, you're going to need me to justify it. So I'm going to justify it. I'm going to take a note of each piece of work that we do, and I'm going to attach a cost to it, an hourly rate cost. And the hourly rate cost will be maybe half of what it would cost if we outsourced it. Excuse me, a third of what we, and then a half of what it would be to if we had a freelancer in to cover it. So it's always cheaper to get this work done in-house. Mm-hmm. It's £40 an hour in-house. If you outsource it, it's 50. If you get a freelancer in to do it, it's 60. Like, that's just how I did it. So eventually I could show them, this part of the business, this design team has made 2 million quid for you as an entity this year. So I go, all right, cool, brilliant. This design team now making money, which was eventually the downfall, because once it got to them making, clawing some money back, they said, well, we can sell that and give that to someone else. They eventually sold the design team to a company. They stitched them up. This company came in to buy it, and they were buying it thinking that we were in charge of like the all the printing materials and stuff all around Wembley Stadium. Little did they know, we were just servicing them. So like they bought a dud, really. They bought this design team that was making money internally, but there was no real charge there.
Yeah.
They could replicate that charge now and charge it back because they owned it. So they probably clawed their money back. But that was the end of my time at the FA. And having been inside that system, it was like, oh, it could have probably came at the right time.
It's like my memory of the FA, right, it was when I was growing up, you know, we were watching football pre-Premier League.
Yeah.
The FA had a lot more clout, as I remember it. Yeah. And if you remember Graham Kelly, you'd ever remember him. Yeah, he was the face of the FA.
Yeah.
And I was like, how was this guy? This guy is so bland and weird. Yeah. How is he the guy that they're wheeling out to be the one that faces the public? And it was such a crazy time back then. And, you know, football was still old-fashioned and it was still run by the old-fashioned men in the FA, who even at that time hadn't changed in 100 years.
Yeah.
Right? It was a really, really stuffy organisation. But then again, it was like, maybe that was part of its charm, was that it was traditional. It didn't change easily. Yeah. It wasn't going to just shift its ideas. But then with the revolution of the Premier League, it feels as if the FA are just this like little distant organisation, don't have the clout that they used to have. The FA Cup, when I was growing up, was the
massive,
the pinnacle of club football. Mason. Day of the year, it was like a real highlight.
Country stopped, didn't it?
Country stopped. Yeah. It was incredible. The whole family had come round the TV and you'd watch the FA Cup. Fortunately, Liverpool were there a lot more than Spurs. Then again, no, Spurs are the king of the FA Cup.
The year ends in one, mate.
And it kind of feels like it's faded to a secondary competition now. Yeah. It's like, you know, who cares whether you win the FA Cup?
Yeah.
What was your take from inside seeing that?
Exactly what you think it is a load of old white men walking around in suits that don't fit them. It's almost like being a shareholder in a whatever company, Fortune 500 company. It's a load of rich old white people that are involved in it, you know? Mm. So they'd have like they'd put token people in there, as bad as it is. They'd put a black guy in, they'd put a woman in, they'd put, they'd just wheel people out, literally wheel people out just to, for optics, which is fucking nonsense, you know. Like, I'd walk around. And
but are they still controlling football?
Who knows? I'm not in it that deep.
But did you get that vibe from it though? It was like, did they feel as if they were just old, they were just pushed off into the corner?
They're a governing body. I don't know how long they will last as as an organisation. They've got the England team, which is where it, that's where the power comes from.
Right.
And the women, especially the women now, because they're more... they're more out there now, like women's football. There was a big push. Like, the things they did good, the things they did well was push women's football, and then they pushed this like England DNA thing, which was like to create winning teams. Their ultimate goal back then was to create a World Cup winning team. They didn't specify men or women, but then the idea was that the men would win it by 2022, I think it was. That was the idea. So like they'd almost put this operation in place to teach people how to play football the England way.
Because sorry to interrupt you, because that was always like, for me, it was like when we used to look at the way the FA used to run it, it was like, why can't England play football? We invented the game. Why is English football shit?
Yeah.
Right. But it seems like they've got their act together a bit now, even under Gareth Southgate, where they're not the best in the world, but they're still qualifying and getting in competitions. Yeah. Did that kind of all... It started then.
It was literally called the England DNA programme.
Right.
So they had kids in there then. The kids at that time were people like Sancho, and Rashford. They were the kids. I'd go up to St George's Park and there'd be the under-14s or under-12s team, whatever it is. And it was those guys when they were kids.
Right.
You know, they're walking around, they're teaching them to play the England way. Mm. When you put them on the pitch, for put Rashford on the pitch in an England shirt, he's like a world beater. At the moment, he's like struggling a little bit for Man U and stuff. But when you put them together on an England pitch, they do play a particular way.
Well, that was the alien to what our English football was for such a long period.
Well, they was watching the German team at the time and how they were structured. They literally picked up their manual, duplicated it, but added the England thing to it, you know?
Right.
But it was the same place then. It was a stuffy boardroom. I'd walk in, tattoos, T-shirt on, because I want to ruffle feathers. Like, that's the reason I'm here. Yeah. I'm here to rub you up the wrong way. I want you to be looking at me and like tooting and like being a little bit funny, you know? But they would do the same thing. Funny you said wheeling out earlier, because it would be, we've got a media thing we need to cover. Something's happened. We need to speak to someone. Let's wheel out Roy. And they literally used to say, let's wheel out Roy. And in the back of my head, you've got him in like a Hannibal Lecter thing. You've injected him up the arse to give him his personality, and you wheel him out, you put him on the BR thing, let him talk, you know. Yeah. It was like,
but he was like the classic company man, Roy Hodgson, wasn't he? He was the yes man. He'd do whatever the company would tell him to do. How he was able to have such a long career is beyond me, because he didn't have any particular, you know, interest in football and ideas, but it's this guy who's just been there for forever,
all over the place for every team you can think of.
But
Southgate was in there then. Southgate's office was next to my office, so you'd walk past. Mm. And he was the same.
Was he managing then?
He was the under-21s manager, I think.
So they were grooming him for that job?
Yeah, he was grooming him to take over the job. But he was part of that whole DNA system, which is, I think, why he's plateaued them now. Like we're talking about, it's probably the same thing about like the creativity, you know, the gentrification of it. Now the team is quite flat.
Mm.
It's got to that point where, like you said, you're qualifying for everything, but you want to win. Mm. You need that little bit of extra. You need that R9 Ronaldo, not Cristiano. You need that R9 Ronaldo with that bit of like, where is this guy come from?
Well, that's interesting, because in Portugal, they have a really interesting structure. I don't know enough of it to really articulate it, but with how they run their football here, this is a big part of their culture here, is that everywhere in Portugal, they have their own clubs, right? And their clubs are really well run, really well funded. Like if you go to Vila do Bispo, have you been seeing the little stadium they've got there?
ODS up the road as well.
ODS, So they really invest in grassroots football here. Yeah. The kids are really well educated in football from an early age. It's not like, you know,
but it's different though.
Yeah,
because they've got like a first 11, and they've got like their favourites. I've seen it, because we used to take the kids football all the time.
Yeah,
because I used to play football at a decent level when I was a kid, and I got to a certain point when I was like, I'm never going to be a footballer. I'm not good enough. But I trained 2-3 times a week, played twice a week, and got to the point where you're playing all the time. They don't do that here. They will throw a 7-year-old on a pitch with an 11-year-old, and it's not like, I don't think the development here is as good. I don't think the development is as good. You can see like a team of 15-year-olds playing, you look at them, you go, wow, they're all amazing.
Mm.
But I think that bit in between, I don't think the development's as good. And that might be a better, that might be.
But they produce a consistently good national team. Might not need the Portuguese. You know, for such a small nation with a small number of people, that, you know, they've competed at the highest level on the world stage for a long time.
I think in a UK system, you get like burnout as well. You know, like you probably know people like I do, and their kid was barely in nappies and they've got a ball in front of them. Mm. They're trying to make them kick a ball. By the time they get to eight, they're burnt out. They've had 100 different pairs of football boots. They've trained with all these different clubs. They're moving them. It's a lot of... A lot of men in England never made it as a footballer, and they don't want their kid to become a footballer. Yeah. Or they look at it from a money point of view. There's another way to do it. If your kid's got a natural gift and they want to play football, let them play football. Don't push them into anything.
It's the money, isn't it?
You know, money is crazy.
Because it's like not only does the child earn enough money to support himself, but he can support 10 families and you know, three generations down the line. That's how much money, that's what's at stake. Yeah. And you can understand some, you know, overzealous parents having the prize in their eye, especially if the kid demonstrates a bit of talent. Yeah. Then, you know, that'll just become, you know, this fantasy in the mind of the pushy parents.
But with a four-year-old.
I know. Imagine some four-year-olds, don't you see them go,
imagine if you took that time you're dedicating to that kid to make him into a footballer, and created your own business and put that time and effort into that, you're going to get to a place where you're comfortable enough anyway, aren't you, eventually?
Mm.
5 days a week sitting out there making them get up in the morning, drink raw eggs or whatever you're doing to them. Like, go and concentrate on you. Like, don't worry about the kid. Let them relax. Let them have fun.
It's a bit of a sore point for me, football, as well, at the moment, because I've distanced myself from it. I've not watched anywhere near as much as I used to watch. And I've kind of, like, rejected this idea of the way that they are politicizing the sport.
Yeah.
And I feel as if, you may disagree with me on this, I feel as if the clubs know that the fans are a captive audience. They know that no matter what abuse they will give to the fans, they will come back week in, week out, buy the tickets, buy the kit, buy all the accessories, spend the money at the ground.
Yeah.
And even if they're beating them over the head with this highly politicized agenda that we're seeing through the clubs, I'm like, nah, football was designed for working men who were putting in 90 hours a week in fucking factories. That was the way they would escape the politics, religion, all that shit. And they would just go and enjoy themselves. And now it feels as if there's no escape. They're still trying to beat it over the fucking head.
Yeah.
What was your take on that, being from the inside?
I think you give the clubs too much credit.
Okay.
Because all they're thinking about is, they're not thinking about influence. Unless you've got like some kind of government member sitting on the board for Liverpool or owns Liverpool. I think it's all about money, and it's all about, all they're trying to do is capture their audience's attention. That's all they're trying to do. They're trying they are trying to sell stuff. That's ultimately what they're in the business for, tickets, merch, blah, blah, blah. But I don't think they take any of it for granted. Every marketing pound they spend is to make sure you're still invested in this club, these players, these people. Otherwise, there's no point in them doing it. They need to make sure they've got you. They're not going to go out and get... They might be able to go into new territories, like the Asian market. That was always a thing, weren't it? Buy an Asian player. Mm. Break into the Asian market because you sell more shirts. I think giving them credit for... Sometimes I think with the political stuff is people just jump on a wave without realizing they've jumped on that wave.
Mm.
You know, they don't even realize they're doing it. But to give clubs that credit for
that... Like, there is no woke agenda... elements that Liverpool FC won't jump on.
Of course they won't.
Especially with Klopp, he was like the ultimate guy. I'll do anything. Yeah. You want me to wear rainbow laces, I'll wear them. You want me to tell them to go and get jabbed, I'll tell them.
But that's part of that ownership group that own it as well, aren't they? Because there's influence from other people. You've got LeBron James is a part owner.
Yeah.
And you saw the way he was flip-flopping on things in the US, like talking about, one minute he was pro-China, next minute he's anti-China, when he gets a bit of feedback publicly. Like, it was all like flip-flopping. And just like we said at the very beginning of this, it's about authenticity, isn't it?
Yeah.
You've got to go back to your core fan base. Like, you're not going to win anyone over by saying something that panders to whatever is going on the news right now. You're not going to sell any more tickets off the back of that, because it's still the same people buying, well, maybe not because you can't really afford it so much, but the same people buying the kits, it's still the same. It's a captive audience.
Mm.
You're not playing up to them. You're just pissing them off. They're losing you. They're losing your kid. They're losing your family member by following that game. If you play up and you talk about the nostalgia and the history of Liverpool, if Liverpool come to me and said, let's make a really cool film about the nostalgia of Liverpool and all the kits we had in the past, and we go out and we make a really cool film and I show you it, you're going, fucking hell, that's got my... I love Liverpool again. That's really cool. I remember that kit with the candy thing on it.
Yeah.
That was my favourite kit.
Nostalgia, isn't it?
Nostalgia. It brings you back. It brings you back round.
Yeah.
But if you're talking about political stuff, it just rubs you up the wrong way, especially if you're politically activated in the first place, because you're going to not agree with something.
But it feels as well as, like, you know, we touched on this when we chatted before. It's like the stadiums themselves are becoming sanitized.
Yeah.
They're losing their identity, their connection to the people who founded the clubs, people, you know, original Highbury, for instance. Yeah. It's called the Library, isn't it? Rather than Highbury, because it's in there. But you said as always, we talked about it before with the kids pushing back with the vinyl. Yeah. There's also groups of fans who are rejecting this, like, official fan name, and they're setting up their own underground, you know, fan base, and they're trying to win back the ground, they're trying to win back the atmosphere, they're trying to win back their club.
Yeah.
And you said there's a little pushback for that with zines and stuff, you know?
Yeah, it's like the zine culture has come back again. Like, zines were a big thing in, like, probably, what was it, like the late 80s, early 90s?
The End, The Farm, Liverpool, very famous zine.
There you go.
Yeah.
And it's like teams now, look, now you've got social media. This is where the cool stuff comes in football. Like, the creativity comes back out, because you've got these, especially like Arsenal, it's the worst. It's so boring. Like, I know I'm a Tottenham fan, but like, it's the most boring stadium in the world. The fans are just but it is dull. It's boring. But then you've got, they're called 1883, I think. They might be wrong. But it's like these zines that used to be a printed thing that you'd maybe read are now like a YouTube channel, when they've got people talking, people commenting, reaction videos, all this sort of stuff that happens on social media. But they sell cool merch, they make their own merch, like cool stuff based on the history of their club, the club that they love. There's no agenda, there's no whatever. It's just like, this is the club we love. These are the stories that we want to tell. This is the cool stuff about this football team. And I'm like, that's the stuff that's interesting for me in football. And that's the stuff, whenever anyone hires me, giving the secrets away, but whenever anyone hires me, it's like the story behind the people behind the people. Mm. So ultimately, the ultimate end goal is on the pitch, two teams playing against each other, what's the result? But to get that ball on that pitch, you've got hundreds, maybe thousands of stories that go into making it, you know, like the guy who cuts the grass, the person who cooks the food in the stadium, the person who changes the light bulbs.
The human story, the narrative.
They've got really interesting stories, and you can tell them till the end of time and make Arsenal, Liverpool, Tottenham, Leyton Orient, whatever the team is, you make them much more like aligned to your people, your fans, by telling their stories, because those people are just like you. The authenticity is where it comes in, because at the moment you're selling something that's inauthentic and you're not telling your story. You've got to represent your brand, don't you?
Okay, well, just before we wrap it up, where do you think design and technology is heading? What's on the horizon? What's new? What's fresh? What's making you excited coming down the pipe?
Well, the thing that's making me excited is this AI stuff, getting rid of all the dead weight and people leaving the industry. Because, like I said before, like, there's so many...
Get rid of the shit.
Yeah, get rid of the shit. And it's true, because people are starting to get found out now.
Mm.
There's agencies, like creative agencies, that have entered into the market based on how much money they've got in their pocket. So they've got 500 grand or they've got £1 million. We're going to start a creative agency. Why? Because it's really fucking cool. I'm going to give myself the title creative director. And they're going to give a new business person some money. And they're getting the jobs, because they can go and get the jobs. Like, if I was to make my own agency, I'd have to work for 6 months, 9 months with no income whatsoever, full time every day, to get to the point where I can go pitch for work and get some work in. It's going to take me 6 to 9 months. I can't do that, because I've got to provide for my family, and you've got to make money. These people are entering into it, but they've got like this structure which they could pick up out of the creative industry, plonk down there into the recruitment industry or estate agency or whatever, and still operate. It's just people in jobs. They don't really know what they're doing. They're just bought into that industry, you know? Like, that's what I'm looking forward to. Them lot getting rid of. Because it's starting to show in the output now.
Bring on more AI.
Bring it all on.
It's finding Skynet is upon us.
It's finding people out. Like, they're getting found out.
Yeah.
And they don't like it. So if you see someone...
But can't they use AI for that, you know?
No, but they can't. That's the point. They don't know, because they...
Because there is a real skill to use an AI. It's not just okay, that's going to do the work for you. No.
We could sit there now. If I had my laptop, we could do a test, right? Yeah. Me, you, and we could all sit there and do it and try and come up with something. We can try and make that post, remake that post, all right? We're gonna do it, and none of us are going to get there, but I might get closer to it than you do. You might get closer, and so on and so on. when you've got no capabilities in the first place, it's very hard to get to the outcome. You know what I mean?
Definitely. Well, I mean, in some ways, Photoshop is AI, isn't it? In some ways.
Because, I mean, they've got a generative fill tool now.
But even before the generative tool, it's like you're still manipulating using those tools. Yeah. You're still pushing buttons, aren't you?
Got to know how to do it.
Yeah, it's got to know how to do it, exactly. And pushing buttons for Midjourney is, you know, not much different than pushing buttons for Photoshop, is it?
It's just another tool.
It's just another tool, yeah.
But if you can't use the tools in the first place, and this is the other problem with these agency models, agency one, come and hire me, they'll give me a day rate for 3 days worth of work, they'll give me X amount of money, they'll go and charge 10 times that amount of money to the end client. Client goes, great, we love it, thank you so much, now what do they do? They have to come back to me, and I'm like, no, my rate's gone up because you've got more clients based. Oh, no, I'm not gonna do that. Then they give it to someone more mediocre in the snake pit of mediocrity, and then it becomes like, oh, well, they didn't do a good job, let's give it to someone else. And then they come back 6 months later and go, actually, we will pay you your money. But by then, hopefully, they've started to take a dive.
Yeah, well, you've got another job somewhere else.
Yeah, exactly.
Okay, cool. Where can people find you, Mason?
You can't. Go fuck yourself. Bye.
Mason Brown, thanks for coming on, mate.
Break the mic.